find her expert advice anytime at thinkblink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Everybody, welcome back to the Elise Gold Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Link. I'm delighted to be with you today. You can find me online during the show and, of course, forever, always online, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. That's the website. When you're there, find the little button that says sign up for the free weekly newsletter. Sign up. Get access to all things Glink. Trust me, it'll make your day. You also can follow me online on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. When you're there, we're always chatting online. There's all kinds of great information we're pushing out and finding new resources for you. So remember, it isn't just about rebuilding your house. It's your financial house. It's your job. It's your business. It's your community. It's your neighborhood. It's all of these things together. That's what we're trying to do with Rebuilding America. So thinking about that today, I invited my friend Sean Moffitt on with us. He is the CEO and founder of The Moffitt Company. I met Sean through another friend of mine, and Sean has something like 345,000 Twitter followers. And when I met him, I did not have nearly that many. I still don't. And I wanted to know how he did it. And so that led into a really long conversation about social media and small business and what small businesses are doing right and wrong. And because at the beginning of this year, I told you that we were going to give you some new tools, some new ways to connect, to develop community, to build your small business or rebuild your small business, I thought I'd invite Sean on the show today to talk a little bit about what he advises companies, because that's what he does. He helps companies build relationships and find their place in the universe. And so he's graciously agreed to come on today and chat with us for a few minutes. So Sean, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thank you, Elise. Such a pleasure to be with you.
It's nice to have you here as well. So I know you spent a lot of time thinking about social media and community and the idea that we're in kind of the beginning of a new place where community is really driving decisions consumers make about their businesses, decisions businesses make about who they're going to do business with or how they're going to build their business. What have you found in the companies that you consult with are some of the best ways to connect their businesses with the communities that they serve?
I have found that a lot of businesses don't get it. And
what don't they get?
I hate to start off that way, but what businesses often don't get about social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, Instagram, Vine, YouTube, is it is not a traditional way to market your business. Traditionally, businesses have thought of marketing as very tactical, very data-driven, very price-conscious, very I'll do this, you pay me that. But social media and social interaction is all about building relationships, building bridges into the community, as you've suggested, building connection between you, your brand, if you are your brand, or what you do, let's say, and someone in the community that could serve to benefit by some of the things that you know.
Well, give us an example of one of your clients that you actually had this problem with and how you turned it around for them.
Absolutely. I was working with a real estate company in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and a fantastic company, very progressive, 450 agents at this brokerage, and they were just simply going online and constantly spamming listings onto Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And I walked in and I said, there's one reason why you have no engagement online, and it's that nobody cares what you have to say because you don't care about who you're saying it to. This is a conversation that happens between between people online. And if you, and what I said to them was, if you go out and just simply constantly post links of things that you're selling, no one is going to care until they can see that you care about what's important to them, i.e. the community and how you can serve it and what's going on and why Toronto is the place to be, or you know, this particular pocket of Toronto. And so we made some quick adjustments and began to start connecting with people and connecting and giving value add to someone's day. And in a real estate vein particularly, this would be things like, where are the best restaurants? What are people doing with their kids in the neighborhood? What are some ideas of things that, you know, could help promote a neighborhood watch or something that's happening in the community or something that that you're rallying around, for instance? And once they took on the idea of, look, we're going to connect with the community first and become a resource for all things community-based, then people cared what they had to say, engaged with them, and in turn, as a byproduct of that connection, they were able to communicate clearly and ultimately close some real estate deals.
So what are some questions that a small business owner should ask himself or herself about their community? How do you get started with that internal conversation about, you know, what it is you should be tweeting about? What do they want to hear from you? You know, what are the connection points that your community is looking for? How do you start that conversation if you're a small business owner? What do you need to think about?
Yeah, First thing you need to ask yourself is, who am I even talking to? Who cares that I'm online right now? And your answer is going to be very close to your target market. And one of the biggest issues that the entrepreneurs that I work with have is, they don't know who their target market is. And often when I ask them about business, I say, you know, who do you talk to, or who is your customer? And they say, everyone. And that's the first big mistake in business. Everyone is not your customer, and everyone online is not going to care what you have to say. Unless, of course, you know, you're President Obama or, you know, Kanye West or Kim Kardashian or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kardashian, maybe.
Yeah, right. Not everyone's going to care who or what you have to say. But your market and your audience is. So first determine who you're talking to, and from that determination, at least, you're going to be able to find out really quickly, hey, if this is the person that I'm talking to, this is what that person cares about, and this is how I can put something through the lens of my brand out into the marketplace that will add value to my client or prospective client's life.
So when you start to build that conversation, you identify these connection points. How do you choose which social media sites to be on? Because, frankly, there are hundreds of places that you could place links and develop content. You know, for real estate agents, one of the places that I think is most interesting is this place called ActiveRain, which has like 340 or 350,000 real estate agents talking to each other. And there are also mortgage lenders. And I have often thought that the best thing that you could put up there would be personal finance information or mortgage information, because real estate agents already know how to buy and sell houses. They're talking to each other about those issues. But if they're going to look for an expert, they're going to look for an expert in something that they are not expert in. So in that place, I would say counter-programming is better than sort of programming. How do you decide amongst the, you know, 25 or 30 or 40 or 400 places that you could be pushing out this information where to go? Is Twitter a must? Is Facebook a must? Is Vimeo versus YouTube or all of them? What do you think?
Yeah, pick one and start there. One of the big mistakes that I made, Elise, when I started getting into social media, I mean, was that I went everywhere at the same time. And it is terribly difficult to scale that. And social media is a conversation, and it is a conversation that a lot of people will engage in if you have something to bring to the table. It's what I call the great equalizer. So to answer your question, I think the best forum to engage in, my personal favorite, is Twitter. Here's why. Not just simply because it's my favorite platform, but I like the fact that on Twitter, you don't need permission to follow people, and therefore you don't need permission to talk directly to them. Whereas guys on Facebook, which is great for realtors because they've got lots of pictures and everything, or LinkedIn, which is the business professional's kind of social media place to be, you either need someone to accept you or you need their email address in order to be accepted or to connect with them. And I just find that to be a barrier, where on Twitter, as long as they're there, you can tweet at them, you can begin a conversation with them, and if your message adds enough value, the likelihood that they will respond is high.
All right, so Twitter starts to be good. So you should do you think you should just basically follow the kinds of people that you would want to have follow you back?
Yes. The first thing that you need to do is open a Twitter account. The second thing that you need to do is to search in the search box the areas of interest for your business. Now, if it's real estate, search real estate. If it's sales, search sales. If it's finances, you know, so on and so on. And this is going to give you a list of people in that space that have a high volume of followers, following, interaction, and you can get an idea of exactly how Twitter works. From there, I want you to follow as many people as you can. And frankly, if you are a small business owner and you're trying to connect socially, follow people in your trade or general demographic or geographic area. Because these are people who can connect with you and your business as you build a relationship. You begin to show them you care. You communicate with them. This is always going to drive them to, you know, possibly close some business with you. So those would be two things I would do. Number one, go on and search out those things of interest and begin to follow people in those spaces. And number two, search out a geographic location in that same space on Twitter and begin to follow people geographically and begin the conversation.
We're talking with Sean Moffitt. He's the CEO and founder of the Moffitt Company. His website is the Moffitt, M-O-F-F-E-T-T company.com. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Sean, I want to ask you, we'll just have a couple of minutes, but I want to know what you can do to encourage your employees to actually spend a little time in social media and encourage them to actually get with the program, because I think it's something that they're not always so keen to do. I'm Elise Klink. We are Rebuilding America One House at a Time. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. We have Sean Moffitt on the phone with us today. He's CEO and founder of The Moffitt Company, themoffittcompany.com, M-O-F-F-E-T-T. You can follow him on Twitter. He already has like 345,000 Twitter followers compared to my puny 12,000. What can I do? But we are so happy to have you here with us, Sean, to talk a little bit about how small businesses can leverage social media, both for community, growing community, and then, of course, converting sales. I have found that not everybody likes to and feels comfortable tweeting into the world of the Internet, but how do you encourage people, executives and staffers, to participate? And do even small businesses need a social media manager, preferably somebody under the age of 30?
Yes.
That's very short. Can you expand?
Yes, of course. But sometimes small businesses don't have the capacity or people power to be able to have a separate manager. So create advocates in your business for your online presence. Empower them. Give them the opportunity to go out and begin to speak on behalf of the company. I have found when I have managed teams that one of their biggest fears is that they don't want to say the wrong thing or mess things up. And if you, as an owner, manager, leader in your small business, say, hey, look, there's no way that you can do that. Here are some guidelines, or let's say the boundaries that our brand is about. Tweet and or post content somewhere in there and engage with your customers, and you'll be doing the right thing. I don't want them to make perfect the enemy of good. I just want them to get online and start sending the message.
Well, you can find out more information at themoffittcompany.com. Sean is based in Toronto, right?
Correct.
Well, thank you for being on the air with us all the way down here in Atlanta. We'll definitely have you back for some more tips and suggestions. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Elise.
All right. We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Steve Ely, the CEO of eCredible. I want to get the latest information on alternative credit for you. There have been some really interesting and dramatic changes. eCredible, as you'll remember, is a company that helps you, if you have a thin credit file or no credit file, helps you develop an alternative credit score so that you can get credit and you can build real credit. It's very, very helpful. All right, we'll take a short break and come back with that. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting, of course, with yours. Don't forget to sign up for my free weekly newsletter, and if you are interested in investing in real estate, go to thinklink.com, click on the red house, it will take you to a page that talks about my new Intentional Investor webinar series. 9 webinars, 9 ebooks. I'd love to say it's a whole lot of fun, but it's only fun if you really want to be a great investor. If you want to be a great real estate investor and take advantage of the best time in history, or the last 6 months of it, to buy investment real estate, that's what you're going to need to get going. Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate by your very own Elise Glink. We have Steve Ely, our good friend, with us on the phone. Steve is the CEO of eCredible. eCredible is a company that helps people who have no credit score to speak of, and either a thin credit file or no credit file, helps them develop credit that they can use to actually get mortgages and auto loans. And it may be for you if you're somebody who's had their credit devastated by foreclosure or short sale, a bankruptcy. It's completely free to join eCredible, ECREDABLE.com. To get more information. And I should disclose that I sit on an advisory board for eCredible, which I just think is a great organization. Steve, welcome back to the Elise Glink Show.
Well, thank you, Elise. It's nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to have you on. So I know that you keep your fingers in this pie of sort of the unbanked and, you know, people who've just been devastated by what's been going on here the last 7 years with the economy. And I thought it would be a good time to check in and see what's going on with eCredible and alternative credit and this world where, as Dave Ramsey likes to say, that, you know, no credit card shall ever live. So what's going on these days?
So there's a lot going on. You know, more and more consumers are evaluating using alternative credit as a tool to help them demonstrate to a potential lender that they are indeed creditworthy and the kind of person that, you know, can live up to a financial commitment and repay a debt that they commit to, even if they don't have a traditional credit score. So we're seeing a lot of interest in that area from every corner of the marketplace. I think one of the most exciting things we're seeing is in the area of prepaid debit cards. You know, as little as 5 years ago, prepaid debit cards was this new financial tool that was really being, you know, issued to people that just didn't have access to any kind of mainstream financial institution. Maybe they had a history of bouncing checks or something. They messed up along the way, and so they couldn't get a regular checking account. They couldn't get a credit card. You know, just something went wrong in their life. So it was really a product built for those kind of people and built for people that might be just getting started out and don't have a credit history. Well, it's kind of evolved now. You know, today in the marketplace in the U.S., there's about 10 million of those kind of cards in the hands of U.S. consumers. And within 3 years, the analysts predict there will be twice as many cards in the marketplace. And so that's quite a growth for that kind of product. And now you have companies like American Express leading the way with their new product called Bluebird, which they released last October. And they market that product exclusively with Walmart. You can walk into a Walmart and see the Bluebird product sitting on a hook and pick it off there and use that card almost like you can a credit card. You know, the fundamental difference between that and a credit card is that with a prepaid debit card, it's just what it says. It's prepaid. When you load $1,000 on the card, once you spend $1,000, it's done. There is no overdraft. There is no credit on the card. It's just finished. And until you load some more money, you can't use it again.
But Well, I'm sorry, finish your thought, and then I have a couple of questions.
Well, I was going to say, one of the good things about these cards is that they work well for all kinds of people now. It used to be these cards were not even FDIC insured, but in the case of the American Express Bluebird card, it is FDIC insured, so you know your funds are safe there, and that you're protected with the American Express payment network. The other thing that's really good about these cards is access to all manner of banking services. With that kind of product, you can pay your bills online. You can obviously shop online. Do the kinds of things that you'd like that you would normally do with a credit card, you can now do with a prepaid debit card. So these cards are really becoming fully featured and pretty useful for a lot of people.
So the big complaint with these cards was always that they were ridiculously expensive. I mean, when the Rush card came out, we had the Kim Kardashian card, the Susie Orman card, right? No Elise Kling card, I'm sorry to say. But the big complaint was that they were just ridiculously expensive and that the people who could least afford it were paying the most in fees. And yet there's some new recognition, and I know you've been talking a lot about this, that these people who have a prepaid debit card, if you get one, you might actually pay more if you had a checking account that you mismanaged. So talk a little bit about how those, because I think the costs are coming down.
Yeah, the costs are coming down for two reasons. One is competition. For example, the American Express Bluebird card is virtually free, and that's a pretty hard price to beat.
Free is good. We like free on this show.
Yeah. And so for the guys that were out there marketing cards that had a $5 load fee and a $2 ATM fee and a $2 service call fee and a $1 statement fee and all these other fees, where you might be averaging, say, you know, $15, $20 a month in fees, that could kind of add up in a hurry. For the ones that were only charging, let's say, $5 a month, though, that's not all that bad for a lot of consumers. And here's the way to think about that, and here's the way that the card issues would tell you to think about it. If you're a typical consumer and you have a checking account and you're living paycheck to paycheck, typical consumer is going to have 3 to 4 overdrafts a year. And at $35 in overdraft, you can see that adds up to about $140 a year in overdraft fees. Well, if you're only paying $10 a month for your prepaid debit card, that's a little bit less than that. So that's kind of how they, you know, did the math to say this is worth it. It's not costing any more than a checking account. Even though you might have free checking because you're likely going to overdraft on occasion, you're going to come out just about the same. So from a cost perspective, a lot of those costs have come down. I will tell you also that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the new agency in Washington that oversees the entire financial services marketplace from the perspective of the consumer, they're looking very closely at these prepaid debit cards and will probably in the near future come out with new regulations that address, you know, making sure that these cards are fair, that they're fairly priced, and that they meet the needs of consumers and have all the proper consumer protections built into them.
Do you think consumers should be afraid of these cards?
No, I don't, because, again, when you get them from reputable companies like American Express or the Chase Liquid card, and there's many, many others out there, they are perfectly safe products. Many of them, you know, I think from a consumer's perspective, you have to shop around and, you know, just start with, is it FDIC insured? In other words, you put your money on that card, is it insured by the FDIC? And if you start there and make that your first decision point, then it's pretty easy to know that you're going to be dealing with a reputable organization. If it's not FDIC insured, maybe you might not want to look at that card. That might that just might be a red flag for you. But these cards are absolutely safe. They're going to become more and more popular. You look at two other uses of them. You know, one is for payroll. A lot of companies now are using these cards for issuing the payroll on instead of writing paychecks. And I'm sure you probably saw some of the recent news that showed up in the New York Times that was complaining about, oh, wow, you know, companies are using these cards and charging employees to get their money off the card. I think those stories kind of misrepresent the other benefits that come with the card that make it perfectly safe for that consumer. For example, if you send somebody a check in the mail and they're going down to a check cashier to cash that check, that's not the safest place in town to cash checks. We all kind of know that.
Right.
And so there's a lot of stories around people that go into check cashers and get mugged on the way out and all those kinds of issues. I think it's worth a couple bucks a month. That's what it costs you to get your money deposited on your prepaid debit card and then know that it's safe and know that you can use it for paying bills and shopping online.
Now, one of the things that you're finding is that there's this tremendous interest in building in a credit, sort of a credit building feature, which, you know, that you are partnering with a lot of these different kinds of companies to build this credit building feature into these prepaid cards, simply because it appeals to a lot of people who are part of the 88 million unbanked or no credit, you know, part of the population. I think most of our listeners might be really surprised to learn that there are maybe 88 million people out in America who don't have a regular credit score. What do you think having that kind of credit building feature will do for these cards and actually for the consumers using them?
Well, a couple things. Another way to think of that number that you just shared is it's roughly one out of four adults, you know, don't have credit and therefore don't have access to mainstream financial services. That's a lot of people. Whether they're young or an immigrant or whatever their background is, that's still an awful lot of people that are excluded from the mainstream financial system. So one of the things that we want to do is with the companies that are issuing these prepaid debit cards is add a benefit to the card so that it allows the consumer to go ahead and use that card the way they would traditionally use it. They might be using it to pay for, let's say, gas, groceries, and movies and things of that nature. But at Ecredible, we don't really care about those kind of spending habits. What we care about are the important bills that you're paying. So bills like rent, your utility bills, your insurance bills, child care, things of that nature. So we would simply say to the consumer, go ahead and load enough cash to pay for the miscellaneous stuff, but it's also load enough to pay for your bills. And when you use the card to pay for your bills, the consumer can choose to share that information with Ecredible, and we use that in our system to help understand how they're building a credit history in our system so that once they graduate to an A or a B, we rate people on a scale of A through F. And so once you earn an A or a B, you can actually use that and qualify for things like an auto loan or a home loan. And that's a pretty big deal for someone that currently doesn't have access to credit or might be new to the country or might just have graduated from college and really doesn't have any history of their own. That's a really neat way to get started, frankly, without having to go into a lot of debt just to prove you're credit worthy.
It's interesting. It almost seems to me like this is the next wave of prepaid debit. We've had 10 years of just kind of getting them into the marketplace, acceptance, driving down the prices, making them more accessible, getting the brand names involved, and now the next benefit is going to be this kind of credit-building feature that you and a couple of other companies are trying to build into these. And it just makes sense to wire everybody up so that everybody can take advantage of all the good stuff that goes on in the digital economy.
Well, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I think the nice thing about the way that we're approaching it is that if there's people that think that, oh, my gosh, here's just another way for me to get in trouble and get credit I don't need, don't think of it that way. The thing that we're going to be able to help consumers do is imagine building credit for a rainy day. And so, you know, if you don't need credit, today the way the system works is that you have to constantly work on your credit, work on your FICO score in order for you to get access to mainstream financial services. So one of the things that we'll be able to do is say to that consumer, no, if you don't want to go into debt to be able to build up your FICO score, that's fine. We'll give you an alternative. Now, the alternative is simply to use Ecredible to have this constant, you know, flow of a track record of you paying these bills on time that really kind of drive our credit scoring model. So when the point in time comes when you do need a car loan, you need a car loan or a home loan, you can absolutely use Ecredible to do that, even though you may not have a FICO score. So I think it's going to be a neat option for an awful lot of consumers, especially for the ones who are just saying, you know what, I just don't want to go into debt. I just don't want to get overextended on credit.
Which is a good message any way you look at it, and one that we talk about all the time on this show. Steve Ely, CEO of Ecredible, Ecredable. You can get all the benefits of being with Ecredible. It's free, guys. You can just go there and sign up and start to chart your own financial future, and I encourage you to do it. Steve, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you, Elise.
All right, we'll talk to you again soon. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little more information for you on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Everybody to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. Well, I know you've been calling, and we're going to take some calls right after we come back from news, weather, and traffic. 404-872-0750 is our number. I will happily pay for the call. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Happy to do that. Sorry to keep you waiting, but, you know, there's just so many people I want to talk to some days that you just got to kind of plow through and get it all done. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. You can go to the thinklink.com blog for information about Sean and Steve Ely, eCredible. We'll provide links to all of those things for you. I want to make sure that you know exactly where to go. For those of you who sent me emails at questions@thinklink.com, I'm going to take a little while at getting back to you. I am going on vacation, so much needed, let me just tell you. You know, when you get to a place where there's just not enough coffee in the world to keep your brain straight, that's the time to take a vacation. So I'm going to do that, and when I get back, then we're going to tackle all of the mail that's in the inbox. But in the meantime, take advantage of everything going on at thinklink.com. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. There is lots of information there and in the entire ThinkLink community for you to take advantage of. All right, stay tuned. We'll be back to take your calls next on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
On News Talk WSB, I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Lines are wide open, 404-872-0750. If you want me to pay for the call, I will. 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can also find me on Twitter at Glink. Currently having some conversations with people on there. Happy to do that with you as well at GLINK. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinklink.com. It has a whole new look and feel. Really cool. It's introducing our brand new thinklink.com store where we're have got the my team and I have got the Intentional Investor Series up. Use code WSB for a 25% discount on anything in the store. That is the best deal going right now. 404-872-0750. Let's go to the phones. Philip joins us on the line from Cumming. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Elise. How are you today?
You know, it's a good day.
Hey, Elise, I listened to you. I appreciate your guests and your comments. It just kind of I've been listening to other money talk shows and just had a kind of a question kind of crystallized. I was wondering if you happen to have any kind of a sense of a feel for a ballpark figure of what would the percentage of the able working Americans, if you have our population 300 million, say like, for example, 160 million, are able to work, we only have, say, for example, 60 million, and there's a percentage of just the able working people. What percentage of the able working people working, what percentage of them working does it take to pay the bills for this country?
I don't know that I understand the question particularly.
Okay, just if you look at the United States, it's just a great big
household. We don't work to pay the country's bills, we work to pay our own bills. But we do. Are you asking a question about taxes? Like what percentage of your income it takes to pay taxes or what it would take to get us entirely out of debt? So I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Okay. There's only so much money that can be generated by tax revenue. And so I'm wondering, I guess that is kind of a tax question, what's the ballpark figure that take to pay our bills? I know we have a president who just likes to spend ad nauseum like there's no tomorrow.
Oh, we've had several presidents who like to spend, of both persuasions. Let's just call it what it is.
It's true. So I was wondering if you could formulate a guess on what does it take, what percentage, I'm trying to look at the percentage of people who are working. We're talking about people on unemployment, the real percentage figure. And so it's down from what it was, a high, probably under Ronald Reagan. What would the figure be where we're breaking even as far as paying our bills? And insofar as revenue generated through income, tax income coming into the government to pay the bills, so that we're not, I know we're spending way more than we're bringing in.
You know, I don't have a specific number for you, but here's what I think and suspect is the answer to your question. It has less to do with people working. The labor participation rate is 5% below the height of where it was before the recession, so it's about 58%. And when you talk about able working people, that's just not how it's quantified. It's working age population.
Okay.
Right? That's how, that is the official classification. So it's working, people who are in the area, in the age bracket of working age.
Okay.
Who are eligible to work.
Right.
So that percent, hold on, I'm getting to your question. Hold on. So that percentage is 58.5%.
Okay.
That, if you got back to 63%, it would be about another 8 to 11 or 12 million people working, which would be great. But none of that is as helpful as having corporations pay taxes and do better. Companies that are not doing well and not making money, their share of revenue to the government is far and away what brings down the deficit over typical people paying in. So you, what you really need to heal are not just, you know, people getting jobs is a reflection of a much healthier economy, and a much healthier economy comes from companies that are stronger and hiring more people. So what you really want to look at is corporate profits and corporate tax revenue over individual revenue. Because if I hire you at $35,000 a year, I, as an employer, am paying a share of your tax revenue to the government. So that has to be, that really is more the measure, I think, from my armchair, that I want to watch, is corporate participation in the tax revenue roll, and is that going up? And what you've seen over the last year is that that share of tax revenue has jumped and is contributing much more strongly to bringing down deficit spending than anything on the individual side.
Okay.
It's got mass and scale. Does that help sort of quantify it a little bit for you?
Yes, it does. I didn't even know it could be have a percentage figure put on it, but
I'm sure somebody out there's got that number. I wish I had it at my increasingly dying brain cells, but I don't. So I can't tell you. I can tell you that there are people, though, who do watch it, and I've seen a number like that come into play. But I do know from all the reading I have done about the economy that what we really want to see are companies getting stronger and hiring more people is just a subset of that. We want to see them get stronger, and we want to see them pay taxes in this country, even at whatever level it is, because that's actually where it all is so much better and stronger. 14 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Link, Rebuilding America. Let's go on with another call. Brian joins us on the line. Hey, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's going on?
I got into a little bit of trouble a couple years ago because I was I lost my job and whole story. And then I had to file bankruptcy. I don't remember. It's the one where you just consolidate everything and I've to pay it off in 5 years.
Okay.
And I'm about halfway through that, so of course, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel coming through, so I'm trying to figure out what would be my next step to do after the bankruptcy is finished.
Well, when you have filed for a reorganization, you need to go step by step through and figure out exactly where you want to be. So are you going to have everything paid off in the 5 years, and how many more years do you have to get through that?
I'm about halfway, so I got about 2 years left, and the only thing I'll have left it will be our mortgage.
Okay, well, that's good, right?
Yes.
All right, have you, so you've got 2.5 years to go. So what you want to do is what everybody else does, which is you're going to have basically zero credit when you're at the end of that process.
Right.
Your credit history will probably be, well, we know it's got a big black mark on it for about the next 10 years, but your actual credit score will probably be either in the upper 400s or low 500s. Right? Okay. So the whole goal is for you to build that back.
Right.
And there's actually a couple of things you can do. So did your reorganization leave you with any credit cards?
No, I have none.
Okay. So what you'll want...
And I had none when I had... I didn't have any when I went into the bankruptcy.
Really? How did you end up in bankruptcy?
Like I said, I lost my job, and we got too far behind on my house. And instead of doing like everybody else did and just going ahead with the foreclosure, we did the bankruptcy so that we could at least keep the house.
Okay. So what, you know, what I want you to think about is, first of all, you're going to have to start from the very beginning. Because if you haven't, was that a real, why did you choose to have, I'm going to back up just a minute and ask you, why did you choose to have no credit cards?
Just because I didn't like the fact of, you know, of, I don't know, I had some bad history with them in the past, and we had gotten some really, you know, high, I think at one point we were over probably $25,000-$30,000 in credit cards, and we paid all that off, and I vowed never to have one again because it was just, you know, it was easy money, and I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to go through that all again. So, other than our essentials like the house and our vehicle at the time, I had, you know, basically just said, okay, fine, we're just going to pay cash as much as we can for everything. If we couldn't pay for it in cash, then we didn't need it, or we had to wait until we saved up the money to buy it.
I wish you had called me before you had filed bankruptcy. I do. Because
I didn't even know you were around before then. So.
Oh, man, I wish you had called me. If I could rewind your clock for you, I would do that. All right, can you stay with us, Brian? We have to take a short break and do some news,
sure.
But I want to come back and I want to specifically answer your question because there are some things that you're going to be able to do, and you're building from the ground up, and I want to make sure this time you build your credit correctly, all right?
Okay, thank you.
All right, stay with us. It is 18 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, starting with your house on News Talk WSB. We were talking with Brian, and Brian went through bankruptcy, has no credit cards. He lost his job, fell too far behind the house, and instead of doing a foreclosure, did a bankruptcy in order to keep the house. I said, Brian, before we went off to commercial break, that I wish you'd called me before all of this happened. And you said you didn't know who I was, so I'm glad you now do. But the problem is that you went for the big black mark on your credit before you actually looked at maybe you did explore some other options, but there was help for people who lost their job and couldn't make their mortgage payments, where they would just literally stop all payments due for up to 6 months and sometimes as long as a year.
Right.
So you went with this one. So now you're in a situation where you didn't have any credit cards to begin with. So now when you come back, you have this big black mark of bankruptcy, and you've got an open slate for rebuilding your credit, and I want to help you do that. So you're going to find it very hard for a while to get any sort of credit cards?
Right.
And I assume you now have a job again, right?
Correct. And one of the things I was going to tell you, too, my paycheck roughly averages around $1,000 a week, and because of our stringent budgeting and everything else, and I also have a military pension, we're able to save roughly around $500 a month.
That's great.
We're starting to try to get a substantial savings in the wings.
But at some point in time, you're going to need credit because
right. You
aren't going to be able to buy another car, you know, without getting a car loan, I would imagine.
Right.
At $500 a month, it's still going to take you a while to save up even for a used car. And things happen, right? Cars break down and houses need fixing. And, you know, if you've got kids, they need stuff too. So I want to make sure that you have the ability to get the loans that you need when you need them. And so one of the things I'm going to recommend for you, there's a company that I am on an advisory board for called eCredible. And they help people who have no credit. I've had Steve Ely, who's the CEO, who's been on the show any number of times to talk about this. It's a company that helps people who are unbanked, who have no credit, or who, like you, had credit but went through a bankruptcy or foreclosure. And there's 88 million Americans who are in this position, who are just like you. And it's a free service. You go there and you sign up. It's eCredable, eCredable.com. And they have lenders, once you get an A or a B in their system, who will help you. Road Loans, which is one of the biggest online applications, places that people go to get car loans, they're part of this as well. And so what it does is it gives you the ability to actually get the loans that you need when you need it. And while you're doing that, after you go through that for a while and you get your back on track with your mortgage and all the rest, you'll start to be able to do a gas card or a secured credit card. And so slowly, piece by piece by piece, you're going to be able to build that up. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com. 404-872-0750. Emily joins us on the line. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Elise. I love your program.
Well, thank you.
I listen to it every Sunday morning, and I listen to it on the web.
Well, fantastic. I'm delighted to hear that.
I would like your opinion about the concept of trying to start a business in staging for homes. The reason I ask this is that I have had a real estate license for over 30 years that I got because I wanted to find out more about real estate. But because I'm visually handicapped and can't drive, I really can't do real estate. I mean,
right.
You have to face it. I'm still very interested in it, like I listen to your show. And I have done it a little bit on an extremely informal basis, simply going to some open houses in a large neighborhood that I live in. And then afterwards, talking with the homeowners and saying, you know, I saw your open house, but did you notice that something, something, something?
Mm-hmm.
And I even had a realtor one time asking me for some suggestions. But I don't know anything about the possibility of the markets, and I was curious if you had any, what your opinions.
Well, Emily, first of all, you're doing all the right things for starting a business. The only thing it seems to me that you're not doing is charging for it.
Yes, that's true.
So I think what you need to do is you need to get a couple of clients who will actually, even if they don't pay you to do this, will hire you to do it for them.
I see.
And, you know, they'll have to pay for all the things that go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can show off before and after photographs. And then the before and after photographs should live on a website somewhere, like emilystagingbusiness.com.
Well, I've got a better title.
Okay, good. But it should live there so that you can send people there to say, hey, this is what I'm all about, before and after. And there should be a little blog where you discuss these things. And I would discuss the mistakes that you're seeing when you go to all these open houses. And going there, you hand out your card and you say, you know, yeah, I would say, here's a couple of quick things, but really, this is a business for me. So I'd be happy to help you out. What I charge is, you know, $50 an hour, $100 an hour, whatever it's going to be. So that's really
great.
How you get started with a business. You know, this is a business that's a service business, right? This is your service.
Yes.
So you have to be able to have some things to show people. I mean, even if you had a little brochure that had a before and after on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had some great marketing data that said, here's how I'm going to change your life. Here, I'm going to help you sell your houses faster and for more money. I think sellers are now understanding that their houses have to look like HGTV sets.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And buyers only want that. In fact, I just had a woman email me saying that every single buyer through her door is looking for her house to be like HGTV, and it has been an absolutely eye-opening thing for her. She had no idea that her house is now supposed to look like a television set. It's as if we're all the Kardashians, honestly. But this is really an opportunity for you, and I do think this business is growing because I do think that we are never going to go back to the old way of selling real estate. Like, we're never going to use these big old books that are black and white photos that have to stay in the realtor's office and nobody can get to them, and you have to go there and make an appointment. Like, no, we're never going back to that life 20 years ago, and people are always going to expect now that houses look like television sets, studio sets, and you can help them do that. And that's an extremely rare and valuable talent. And I think it's a great business idea for you. Now, I will say to you that you should really do it for yourself and take it one step further and look at investing in houses yourself and making them look like HGTV sets and selling them.
I hadn't thought about that because I do have the capital to do that.
This is what I was talking about with my intentional investor series, right? It's all about building up your own business. And so you might earn $100 an hour, let's say, doing this for brokers in the neighborhood. But you only have 8 or maybe 10 hours a day that you can sell.
Right.
So that's $1,000 a day. It's a great living if you sold every hour of every day, which you're not going to. But now you buy a house for $50,000 or $100,000, and you stage that house, and you do some minor fix-ups to it, and you make that house look amazing, you might make $40,000, $50,000 just on that one house.
And I get to go look at the houses, too.
And you get to go look at the houses, and you get to go, you got your realtor license. Like, you have a lot of the pieces in place that I talk about when I talk about being an intentional investor. You have all of those pieces in place. And so for you, the game isn't about staging other people's houses, which I think you could, but going there and literally making the move yourself, staging it, and blowing it out of the water. And really, if you want to start your business, that's the way to do it.
That's
because
the way to do it.
You're going to go find a really ugly house, take a ton of pictures of it. You are going to make that house look amazing. You'll make the money on selling the house, and now you've got the basis for everybody else to come to you and say, oh, could you make my house look like that too?
I'll keep you informed.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Elise.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening to the show. Have a great afternoon. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I love that Emily's going to do this. She is my definition of an intentional investor, every way, shape, and form. Jonathan joins us on the line from Dallas. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I kind of have a two-part question that I've been trying to get confirmation on and maybe some reassurance. I thought you would be a great place to ask that question.
All right, lay it on me.
Okay, about 3 years ago, wife and I bought a foreclosure in a beautiful neighborhood for about $179. The house had sold for 3 years before that for $325. We got a heck of a deal, but the time has come. We're expecting our second child. There's only 3 small bedrooms, but we were looking for just another bigger house with more bedrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a couple houses in the neighborhood has sold for, you know, $260, $270 within the last couple of months. The thing is, I've seen the mortgage rates going crazy the last couple of months, and, you know, we have a 4.75 rate, so we have a great rate now. So the scary part is...
Okay, wait, let me just jump in right there and say...
Go ahead.
Repeat what you just said. You have a 4.75% rate. It's a great rate.
Yes.
Mortgage interest rates are not even at 4.75% right now. So when you say they've been going crazy, they're not even going crazy to where you are.
Well, I saw it last week. One day it jumped up to 5.
It really got to about 4.25 last week, maybe 4.5. It's not,
okay.
It wasn't really up at 5. And anyway, it's pulled back a little bit this week. And yes, it will go higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted, for everybody else listening, I just loved hearing you say that because there's been this sense of loss of proportion when it comes to mortgage interest rates that I find to be completely hysterical. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead with your question.
Well, I guess my shorter question is, so you kind of cleared that up, you know, if we're going to put it on the market this coming week, and if those rates, do we see it getting past that 4.75 that we already have? And then if it's not, the potential, couple gains that we're going to make on this house, do we put that full part on the next down payment for the new house, or do we just put the 20% down that we make and keep the other for future investments?
So, great question. First of all, I love the idea that you're going to put at least 20% down because that's how you get the best rates and the best everything. What you may want to
get rid of that PMI too.
Yeah. Now, is the next house going to be the next house for like the next 10 years?
Of course, yes.
Well, you say of course, but you know, when you actually make the decision, I talk about being an intentional investor, right? I want you to think about that, because I'm going to recommend that you actually go for a 15-year loan, because you'll be able to get that at about 3.25%.
Okay.
And if you go with a 15-year loan and you stay in this next house for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
you are going to almost completely pay off that loan. And you'll have, as a backup, all this extra cash that you made on it to enable you to do that. And just in case things get a little bit tight, you'll have this wad of cash sitting in a bank account somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Which you can always use for your kids' college educations, down the line. There's all kinds of uses for extra money. I have never run out. I have never run out of ideas for extra money use, right?
That's right. That's right.
So I think what you should do, sell this house. What you get will be tax-free. Which is amazing that you could almost get $100,000 out of this house tax-free.
Exactly.
Think about that. Maybe you walk away with $80,000. You'll go buy another house for maybe, what, the $250,000,
$300,000? Exactly. That's what our range was between $250,000 and $265,000, I thought, would be keep our mortgage payments almost the same with our down payment.
Yep.
We almost have the exact same mortgage payment.
And then you've got this big pot of cash that's sitting there just waiting for you to do something with.
Okay, yeah.
Love it.
That's what we wanted.
Yeah, and so it sounds like you're making all the right decisions. So I don't know that I'm telling you anything that you don't know inside yourself, which I love, because it really means you are being intentional, you are being thoughtful. You and your wife have really kind of thought this through. You were willing to go out there and take a risk when nobody else was, and all of that is great news. Jonathan, I think you got it going there.
Well, I appreciate it, and I think that's what I needed. This is reaffirm what I was thinking.
Well,
make sure I make the next good steps.
You are on the right path. Let me know what happens, all right? 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glenk. We're rebuilding America one house at a time. It's 11:48 on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glenk is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Annette joins us on the line. Hi, Annette.
Hi.
What's going on?
I had to take a good bit of my retirement out back in 2011 to help my daughter in a situation. And also, I maxed out my equity line of credit. And, of course, the government got a good tax money out of it. And I'm paying a pretty good penalty now plus interest. And I'm wondering if I should go from my equity line of credit is in a fixed just interest right now. And I was wondering if it would be better to go ahead and put that in a fixed rate before the interest rates start going up. Or would it be better to get a mortgage or see if I could get a loan, pay the equity line off, and also pay the government off?
We have to backtrack a little bit because your question's kind of complicated and there are other issues involved. So.
Okay.
What happened with your daughter?
She was going through a very dangerous, bad divorce, and I had to buy her house. My house was not big enough, and so we didn't have a whole lot of time to shop or to go through a real estate. I went through several banks. No one wanted to really loan me any money because I had just retired, and my income had, you know, drastically.
It had dropped, right. You didn't have any. Okay. So
yeah.
you cashed out your retirement account to buy your daughter's house for her?
Not all of it, but a good portion of it.
Okay. So you did that, and now you had taxes to pay to the government.
Correct.
Okay.
And
we knew
that.
And what was that tax bill?
It was $34,000, and the state got $7,000, but I've already paid the state off, and I've got the federal government down to $23,000.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yep.
All right. So your daughter has the house. Is she working?
Yes.
And is she safe?
She's safe, yes.
Okay.
And the children are safe, yes.
Okay. So that's the most important thing.
Yes, ma'am.
So, the tax bill is annoying and expensive and a headache, but she's safe, and that's great. So now you've got this equity line of credit, and I'm sorry to tell you that just because of what you've had to do to get your daughter and your grandchildren safe, I don't think you're going to be able to find anybody to lend you more money right now.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a tax lien and you start to complicate your credit history takes a real beating and a credit, your credit score drops. Have you checked your credit history
and
score?
Yes, I got a letter from SunTrust just this week, and it's $799. And see, I own three properties. I own the house that, my daughter's in.
Mm-hmm.
I own the house that I'm in here, and I also own a cabin. All of that's paid for. And like I said, on paper, I've got the equity in real estate. I just owe about $125,000 to $140,000.
And you're retired.
Yes.
I still am going to go with the same comment, which is that given that you are retired and you're not, you don't have a full-time income, and even though you've owned all these assets, I don't think your credit score is really where they say it is. But you should go to annualcreditreport.com. Get a free copy of your credit history. Buy your credit score for about $10 from the Equifax because it's really close to FICO. And see where it is. If it is high, you can try to refinance. But I don't think the refinancing is really the issue for you right now. It's an income issue, and you've got to figure out how to raise your income so that you'll be able to afford to pay this. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.